Welcome to the Sunday Night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program and what the speaker has shared. Please help me welcome Janet Z. from Los Angeles, California, a compulsive overeater. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for the introduction, Donna. Hi, I'm glad to see I'm not the only compulsive overeater not watching the football game today. I wondered if we'd have anybody besides myself and the leader. I am a compulsive overeater, and I'm from Los Angeles, and I'm really glad this is audio only because I have this lock of hair that will not lie down straight. And we know how crucial that is to my well-being. I am grateful to be here. I'm a 100-pounder. I'm down over 100 pounds from my top weight. And I don't have much documentation, but let's see. I do have a picture that tells the story. That was me. And I was hopeless. In enough denial to not, I was hopeless that I'd ever be a normal body weight or anything adjacent to that. And in enough denial that I could still move through the world. And my story doesn't start out that way. I was a slim child, and I was always food oriented, and I was highly motivated by sugar, and it didn't catch up to me until around 14 when I hit puberty. And I was I had my first binge when I was 15, and my parents had gone to Tijuana for the day with my aunt and uncle, who were visiting from New York. And I knew I had the whole day to myself. And there was this defrosted dessert thing that I kept slicing at, one slice at a time, until suddenly it was gone. And then I ran to the store with my heart just jumping out of my chest, bought another one of these things, brought it home, defrosted it, and then ate it down to where it had been before, and was terrified I was going to get caught. And I knew I'd be in trouble, but I don't think I was as afraid of what that meant, that I had eaten all of that. I think I was more focused on getting in trouble because my parents made my weight the focal point of the family. And so they took me to pay and ways. I was 14 when I went to my first pay and way. I was 16 when I went and got diet pills and shots from a doctor within walking distance from our house. And I did lose weight. I did lose some weight. I think I was about 20 to 25 pounds overweight. And I did lose like 15, maybe 20 pounds. And, but I hadn't slept in 3 months, and I was a wreck. And as soon as I stopped taking the pills, the weight came back on. And all my parents wanted from me was for me to be a normal thin weight. And that was more important than whether I took the SAT, went to college, was engaged in my scholastic activities. And all they cared about was, is she thin? And I was also extremely, I was shaped like my grandmother. I was round on the top, round in the middle, and then, you know, straight from the rest of the body down. So by the time something fit me in the middle, it drowned the rest of me. And I looked like a clown if I let my mother choose my clothes. And it was with great enthusiasm, I adopted a hippie lifestyle because then I could make my own clothes and I could fit them the way I wanted to, and they were easy to make. And what happened with that was I was with some friends in the park and we stayed past curfew, and the police picked us up and kept us at the station until 2 a.m. and then called our parents. And my mother took my hippie clothes out to the backyard the next day and set them on fire and gave my sister $40 to buy me a new wardrobe. I mean, you really could get something to wear for $15 back then, but $40 was not going to buy me a new wardrobe. So their focus on my weight was so disturbing to my well-being that I became so inured to it that I wound up marrying a young man at the age of 20 who took over where they left off. He began, and I was out of the pan into the fire, and I didn't understand why I couldn't lose weight. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. I didn't know that I had a deadly disease of addiction, and that I could not stop eating because I had an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. And it would take me a long time to learn this. All I knew is that I would diet and diet and diet. And then the minute I had something with sugar on it, I was off to the races. And each time I put back the weight with more than I had weighed before I did the last diet. And I think I was 23 when I found OA in 1980. And I was well under 200 pounds. And I lost weight and I got to a normal size and I got involved with the program. And I started working the steps with a sponsor. And we do have kind of our own language that we speak, this 12-step speak. So if you're new, it takes a while to kind of get the idea of what all these things mean. And it's kind of a shortcut way of saying, I didn't know what was wrong with me. Why couldn't I just behave, lose weight, and be and you know, make everybody happy? I thought my job was to make everybody happy. So I was dissociative. I was dissociated from my body because I talked about it as though it were a science project. And I participated in the idea that I was some kind of a project to be fixed up. And when I finally got to the program and started to learn about the disease, it was still about losing the weight for me. It was still about how do I look normal and pass for normal when I've got this, you know, major binge eating disorder. And my marriage did not last long. I had gotten to the point where I realized that I did not need someone's thumb over me and that I could live my life on my own terms. And I got my own apartment. And then the binging really, really took off. And that led to my coming to OA in 1980. And I had some recovery. I never put more than a year and a half of back-to-back abstinence together because food was still an option for me. I didn't get the no matter what portion of working this program. And after I stayed till 1994, when I was straddling, I had 1 foot in OA and 1 foot in HOW, and they were the same program at that time. They hadn't split up. And I felt one was too punishing and the other was too forgiving. And let me just think about this a minute. I took a step back from the program, and 20 years passed like that. And that top weight that I just showed you was achieved by doing more research out in the field to see if there was an easier, softer way. I did not want OA to be the answer. And I did the one thing that I'm going to urge you not to do, and that is don't leave. Don't give up your seat in this program. I beg you. This is the last house on the last block. This is the place for people for whom their relationship to food and weight causes a major disturbance in their life. This isn't for somebody who sometimes eats a little bit extra and put on 15 pounds over 20 years and doesn't have a problem. You're still welcome. You're still absolutely welcome. But the point of what I'm trying to say is it's for people whose quality of life is diminished by food. People who, so-called normal eaters don't feel suicidal after they gain 5 pounds. That's not considered, a natural part of taking off a few pounds. And while I never personally felt suicidal, I heard a lot of stories about people who just didn't want to go on. And I didn't not want to go on with my life. I just didn't see how there was a way forward. And
that's 10 minutes.
Okay, great. So what happened while I was out there, I availed myself of outside help. That is an outside issue for OA, but there are a lot of us in these rooms that don't talk about it. And I did have weight loss surgery, and that did not fix what was wrong with me. It did not fix what was wrong with me. And it was 9 years later that I finally clawed my way back to OA and had an experience that is nothing short of miraculous. While I was eating and using food to anesthetize myself, to keep myself from feeling my feelings, to keep myself unable to grapple with what my real problems were, I hit a low bottom with depression, and I did not work for 5 years. And my husband and I required two incomes to afford our lifestyle. And I still don't know what bank he robbed to keep us going, but he somehow managed to keep a roof over our head while I was completely disabled. And I finally got back to OA, and within 30 days of being abstinent, I got a job doing filing in a fellow's office. And I had not been able to leave the house by myself. And I had not been able to drive more than a couple of blocks from our house when I did manage to get outside. My anxiety was so off the roof. And I immediately got a sponsor. I had a moment of clarity on the Sunday night of Thanksgiving weekend of 2014, when I was getting ready to go out and buy some crappy candy at the 7-Eleven at 11:30 at night, when it was not safe to do so. And I saw myself clearly. I saw myself, and I just thought to myself, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I had this flashback to all the abstinent holidays I had had, and the truth of the matter being that the happiest times of my life had been when I was abstinent. And I got on my knees and I asked God, that I didn't believe in, to help me. I just said, God, I don't believe that you are there, but if you are there, I'm desperate and I don't know what to do and I need some help. And that is a version of, turns out, that's kind of a version of the lunatic's prayer in the big book, in Our Southern Friend, one of the first stories. I think it is the first story after Dr. Bob. And he's talking with our Southern friend. They're in the insane asylum together. They're locked down, and he's being treated for alcoholic drinking. And he says he doesn't believe in God. And then he suddenly has this thought. Comes in his mind, who are you to say there is no God? And he gets up and he runs down the hall to the other inmate and says, I've had this experience. And the other so-called lunatic looks at him and says, when you pray, do you ask God, give me this or that? And our Southern friend says, yes. And he says, but that's not it. That's not how you do it. It's, here I am, God, and here's the mess I've made of my life, and I can't do anything about it. So you take it and you do with me what you will, and let the signs be large. And I'm just paraphrasing. And that was my experience. My experience was, there was this loving presence that I was soaking up, that was saying to me, you don't have to do this anymore. And I knew in that moment that I had been relieved of the obsession. I took my shoes off, got ready for bed, and got up the next morning for my first abstinent day. And I called a friend I knew in the program and said, I have 12 hours of abstinence and I don't want to lose it. Can you help me? And she said, yes. And so I went to meet her at a 7:30 meeting that following Sunday. And when she asked me to come, I opened my mouth to say, I don't think so. I don't get up till 8:30 on a weekday. What am I going to do at 7:30 on a Sunday morning? And out came, okay, I'll be there. And I did. I went there. And after a lifetime of struggling to get up in the morning for my entire life, I was suddenly struck a morning person. And I get up between 5 and 6 every morning now. And I just had this spiritual experience of the knowledge that the problem had been lifted. And I got to work with my sponsor. I got to work on the steps right away. I did my fourth step. It wasn't my first, it wasn't my 40th, but I did it. And I got on paper everything that I felt bad about, that I was resentful about, all the harms I had caused. And I took a look at them with the eyes of a more experienced OA-er. And came up with an action plan. And the when I got to my ninth step amends, 7/8 of my amends were financial. I hadn't worked in 5 years. My car had been repossessed. My credit cards had tripled with over the limit and late fees. And I mean, it was a mess. It was a mess. And I got to work on it. And I started paying off my debts. I started making arrangements with my creditors. This was my nine-step amends, and they were going to take some time. It wasn't, you couldn't flip a switch and, oh, I made my amends and I'm done. And that was in 2015. Well, at the end of 2016, my car died. And I, once again, turned to God of not my understanding, but at least I had a relationship I'd been working on through the steps and through prayer and meditation, step 11. And I heard, you're going to get a car. And so I drove to the dealership and I looked for the most sensible car I could possibly afford, and walked out that night with a brand new Toyota Corolla and on my signature, because my credit had been repaired because I had made my amends. And I didn't know that was going to happen. I just knew I couldn't live with these unresolved issues, and that my relationship to money and debt had been bad enough for me to go to another 12-step program to deal with that during the time I was out of OA. And so I knew I had to take care of these problems, that they were going to lead back to the food if I didn't. So what happened was, I went to work for an intergroup near my house, and then another intergroup about 15 miles away reached out to me, and I went to work for them. And the next thing I knew, I was prosperous. I was having this healed relationship with money, and I was having this healed relationship with my husband. What does this have to do with not eating compulsively one day at a time? It's about learning how to be a fellow among fellows, a citizen among citizens, a worker among workers. It's learning how to show up, be self-supporting through my own contributions, which is tradition 7, and working to the best of my ability to make a living amends to my husband, to one day at a time never put him in the position of having to float the entire household again. And as a result, is that, what do I have left? That's 20 minutes?
Yeah, you have 10 minutes left.
Okay, great. Yeah. So what I want to tell you about is the miraculous life I have today. I, you know, my story is one of coming from the floor where I was the most unproductive member of society that I knew, to finding my place in my society by being a contributing member, and how that happened. And the first step was admitting that I was powerless over food, and I had no trouble admitting my life was unmanageable, and certainly unmanageable by me. And doing the second step and seeing that I, you know, in order to be restored to sanity, I have to be in agreement that I'm insane. And one look at my life and the wreckage that was going on in it was kind of enough. And then the third step, I made a decision. That's all the third step is, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this power that's greater than myself, this benevolent force in the universe that has taken away my problem root and branch, that has taken away the compulsive obsession. Once I understood that I had an addiction of the body and an obsession of the mind. Food was no longer an option for me. And I do not ingest sugar and white flour. There are quite a few things I don't eat besides that. It's not this simple, oh, I just don't eat white flour and sugar and I'm good to go. I have a food plan, and I have an abstinence, and that's populated by a food plan. And that tells me how my abstinence tells me how many times a day I'm going to handle food. And my food plan tells me what I'm going to eat at those meals or snacks or whatever you work out with your sponsor. I got freedom from taking those three steps and then doing my fourth step and then sharing it with my sponsor, my character defects in 6 and 7 became humble enough to ask God to remove these shortcomings. And then made the list. I already had the list. I was chomping at the bit. And then 9 step, I started making these amends, these living amends, these financial amends, and I stopped doing the things that caused me harm. And in order to stay in today, I need to stay current with my own emotional state. And that's not always easy. I don't know about you guys, but when I first got here in 1980, I wouldn't know an emotion if it slapped me across the face, because I was so busy trying not to feel them. I knew like real high highs and real low lows. And I didn't know feelings in between. And there was a saying, it's not a very pretty saying, but we used to say in OA back in the early 80s that the knife would go in, come out the back, and twist before we'd say ow. And that was me. I had taught myself, put it away, don't feel it now, we'll take it out and look at it later when we're alone. And that was my modus operandi. And I really didn't know any of these things about myself. All I did was I put one foot in front of the other, and I took direction, and I did things that I didn't understand why I was doing them. And when I was struggling, I spent 4 years trying to get abstinent again before I left in 1994. I could not get abstinent. Well, I had a lot of obstacles. Sam Shoemaker in AA coined the 4 impediments to having a spiritual experience. And those are having a secret I won't tell, having a vice I won't give up, having a resentment I won't let go of, and a reparation that I won't make. Those are the 4 impediments to having a spiritual experience. And I had all of those. I had all 4 of those going for me. And when I, so I abstained from December 1st, 2014, and took a 6-year candle in 20. No, I didn't take my 6-year candle. I took my 5-year candle in 2019. And then in 2020, during the shutdown, I became vague with my food. I became less transparent. I became unwilling to weigh myself. And when my sponsor finally put the fire to my feet and I got on the scale, I had gained over 20 pounds. And so I had to ask myself, how does this coincide or add up to our definition of abstinence in OA, which is, you know, working towards or maintaining a healthy body weight while abstaining from our individual binge foods and compulsive behavior. And I had to say, I was not in alignment with that. And I restarted my abstinence in October of 2020. And I have been abstinent since that day. And I have been so gratefully, I'm a grateful recipient of the 10-step promises, which is that that we will recoil when tempted, will recoil as if from a hot flame, and that we will not, you know, we will not be tempted because we will be put in a place of neutrality, safe and protected, and that that is the promise. After you know, we've gotten to the 10th step, you know, the promise is that we're going to have the problem removed. And I don't believe that that's just for a few lucky people. I mean, alcoholics who cannot stop drinking, who are absolutely, their lives are going down the tubes because they can't stop, are suddenly able to achieve and maintain sobriety. It's the same gift from my higher power that takes away the obsession to eat. And my job is to stay in service, to give back what I have so generously received, to sponsor. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I stick close to the book.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay.
I stick close to the book, and I stick with people with long-term recovery, because it really, really helps me when they tell me to do something that they've done. I believe them and I do it. And I just know that the only mistake I can make is to give up the seat that I already paid the price of admission for. And that it's possible to have a new experience of this program, no matter how long you've been here. It's possible to have a new experience and to set aside everything you think you know and get some direction from somebody. And I'm a real believer that the blueprint is in the AA Big Book. And I want to thank Jessica for asking me to come out and share. I didn't really come anywhere. I'm in my living room, but it's been a pleasure to share experience, strength, and hope. And I hope that that some of what I said was helpful to a person in the room. Thank you.